Hello and welcome to episode 29 of That Yoga Woman's Podcast, a podcast where yogis, yoga teachers and studio owners share stories of their lives on and off the mat. I'm Jules Buchanan, a yoga teacher and your host. This week I'm talking to Peter Eyre. Peter is another one of my guests based in the Northeast. In fact, I need to share that I actually work for him at the new hot pod he's set up with his partner Ali up here in the lovely market town of Morpeth. Having made the decision to take on a hot pod franchise just before the start of the pandemic, their timing hasn't made this an easy process. So I'll find out how he's managed to secure a space and set up a new yoga studio during multiple lockdowns. I'll also be asking him what working as a franchisee has been like and why he and his partner decided to go down that route rather than establish their own studio and brand. Prior to teaching yoga, Peter was a head teacher, and he made the decision to leave his educational career to start his yoga business. So I'll find out how easy that decision was for him and his partner, Ali. Ali's still a head teacher, as well as what the pros and cons are of managing a school. I'll also be asking him how his career progressed to the point and whether he'd always wanted to be a teacher from the start of his working life. Outside of work and yoga, Peter was born in Zambia, of all places, and was really into sports in a competitive way when he was younger. We're talking county level for rugby, swimming, and he was even really, really good at the pole vault. Nowadays, he's got a passion for surfing and loves being part of the surf community in the area. Yes, there's apparently more than just Peter that loves going out in the freezing cold water off the northeast coast to enjoy the waves. I'll be asking him more about that, as well as how yoga combines with surfing. I'm also interested to know what first led him to yoga sessions. On top of this, he's also well into interiors. Peter and Ali, I mean, most of us could say we like interiors, but they are at another level. Their current house, which is on the beach, is going to be featured in Good Homes magazine soon, which is amazing. So I think you'll agree there's a lot of ground to cover. I really hope you enjoy listening to our conversation. So Peter, thank you and welcome to That Yoga Woman's Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Very well, thank you, Jules. Nice to be here.
Good. Can we start off by talking about how we met? Your new hot pod franchise is in the lovely market town, I think it's a market town, of Morpeth, and you launched just at the end of May. So how are you finding it so far?
I think it's been a bit of a whirlwind, really. We were obviously anxious about launching at this period of time, post-COVID, worried about any other restrictions. And obviously, it's a new venture for Morpeth. There isn't really anything, well, there isn't anything Northumberland like this. There's no hot pod, obviously, but there's also no other hot yoga that we're aware of. And there's kind of lots of independent, small yoga outfits, but not much locally, really. So it felt to bring something that was a bit more of an established studio that would be like having 7 days a week kind of classes, a little bit of a jump into the unknown. So, but from that point of view, we've been overwhelmed really by the response that we've had. We've had nothing but positive feedback from people who've come through the door, really. And we've been putting on more classes since we started, and more people are coming than ever before. So it's been great, just as we would have hoped, I suppose.
Good. So can you please just tell the listeners and me a little bit more about the background of your decision to take on the franchise, like just as far as timing goes, and that in line with like the pandemic happening and the impact on like securing the rights for the space, the setup of the space and all that kind of stuff. Can you just take us on your journey a little bit?
Yeah, it kind of began in real terms, I suppose, because the pandemic seems to kind of be the condensed or expanded time, depending on which way you look at it. Ali and I were both head teachers, so we've both been in education all of our kind of professional career, really. And we'd got to that point where we were enjoying the work. We totally value the importance of education, but also being a head teacher or senior leader in any school, or teacher for that matter, is always challenging. And I think we'd been doing yoga more ourselves, enjoying it, and started just to have those questions about is there something else we could do as we got older that would benefit us but bring the benefit to other people. So we'd still be in education, for want of a better word, but kind of people who chose to be there and they wanted to be there, so that we'd be having those conversations. And then at the back end of probably say 2019 coming into 2020, things were particularly challenging in Ali's school initially, for kind of local reasons, in that they decided to close Ali's school, which was doing extremely well. It had been a really challenging environment for Ali to work in, and everybody had acknowledged that Ali's leadership had brought the school massively forward. So everyone was really pleased with what she was doing and the school was rocketing forward. But the local authority decided to close the school because of numbers in the area, which seemed quite harsh and political. It was Ali's first headship. So, you know, understandably, we both felt a bit kind of squeezed by the system, as if we were pawns in that system. So we started talking about it. And as part of a closure, there was Ali was then facing redundancy after a first headship, having done exactly the right thing. So as part of a redundancy package, people get offered opportunities to train. And between the two, it was like, well, why don't you just train as a yoga instructor? We love it. And Ali did that. We said, right, we may as well. So she took the opportunity to start training with Hot Pod in London. And as teachers, we're really fanatical, I suppose, about the quality of training that you receive. And we've been going to the Hot Pod in Whitley Bay locally and really, really enjoyed it. Ali's got psoriatic arthritis, and particularly we felt as though that really helped her joints and her skin. With the additionality of the heat, which we'd never really done before. But she did that training. It was kind of over 6 to 8 months. Like, it was in blocks. It wasn't as an intensive month-long training. And literally after the first week, she came back and just said, the quality of training is insanely good. And for Ali to say that, I knew it must have been amazing. And obviously at the same point, she's like, they do franchises. So that just got us thinking. And that was probably, middle of 2019, back end of 2019, I suppose. And then literally almost as she was on to the middle of her training and lockdown, all that kind of stuff was just about to start. My schools, I had two schools, a primary and a secondary school, that had been doing really well. Primary doing really well. Secondary had moved from kind of one of the lowest performing in the local authority to one of the highest performing in the local authority. We got an Ofsted inspection that didn't go my way. I was quite strong-minded as to the reasons behind that. I felt really quite unjustly treated in that process. And then also a bit like a premiership manager, felt as though everybody was looking to me to accept that there was faults, and I didn't believe there were. I felt there was some politics going on and I saw lots of different viewpoints, but ultimately I was in quite a challenged position at that time. And so Ali had just been really unjustly treated variously, and then I was being put through the same thing. So basically what happened at that point was Ali almost at that time got another job, which was a really good job. And we just said, right, let's look into the franchise. And actually I'm going to train as well. And I'm going to step away from headship. So I made the difficult decision to basically say, I'm not really happy with what's happening here. I don't really agree with it, which left me nowhere to go really other than say, so I'm going to go. And I left there at that point and then started training, and we took out the franchise in January. It'll be 2020. And literally just on my first training weekend and Ali's last training weekend about the same time, was like, just as things were hotting up, and it was like, we might have to start closing things down. So we never obviously anticipated what would happen. And we paid for the franchise, I think, in the January, February time. And literally about a week after, we went into the first kind of lockdown. But fortunately for us, the training continued because it was viewed as a form of education, which of course it was, and it was done in a COVID secure manner down in London. So I still kept going down to London to do my training over that period of time and started to look for properties. But obviously it was really difficult to find a property at that time because everything was shut down for a while. Obviously even estate agents weren't open, so it was just like trawling online and seeing what was there, and there wasn't much at the time. And then come August, Ali finished for the summer. We went away for a couple of weeks and then just came back. I came back early to do my training and left Ali abroad. And I just thought, I'll have another Google and see if there's anything there. And I literally stumbled across the current studio space in Morpeth and thought, that looks ideal. And walked in, had a viewing, and just straight away kind of said to Ali, I think this is the one. Because it immediately looked like I had quite a lot of work that it would need doing, but I'm quite ambitious, like in terms of being able to look beyond the facade. And I kind of probably slightly arrogantly thought, oh, I can do that. So then we started to push that process. But inevitably, that process took quite a while because of solicitors being off and the COVID restrictions, and also not wanting to sign a lease when we didn't know what was going to happen. Because invariably, when you sign a lease, you're kind of trying to negotiate some period of time that is rent-free. But then you don't want to have that rent-free period when you can't open your studio or can't do anything else. So that just was a back and forth. And eventually we were about to sign the lease just before Christmas, just as we went into another little lockdown. So we we signed a pre-lease, basically saying we will do this lease when we kind of come out of lockdown. There was some other things with the property. It needed some removal work, which was the liability of the landlords. So I wasn't prepared to take on the lease until that had been done and been checked. So basically that was the back end of December. So we went into Christmas knowing we'd got the property and that we would be liable to that property at some point, but not now knowing when lockdown was going to lift. We got the keys on March 3rd and I started knocking everything out myself and trying to do as much as I could, because again, it was limited, because as most people are probably aware at that time, although things were starting to open back up in terms of trades, everybody was stowed under with like loads and loads of work. Supplies were low on the ground, but also like stupidly expensive. But I was desperately trying to refit the property as quickly as possible and as cheaply as possible on my own so that we could open as soon as Boris said things can open again. It's kind of a little bit serendipitous that yoga studios were unfairly hit through the lockdown process, in my opinion, in that they weren't allowed to open when gyms were. But from my point of view, selfishly, actually, I couldn't have opened any sooner than when Boris said we could. So the restrictions finally lifted on May the 17th. The studio was kind of ready, but there was enough teething things, I think, to allow us just to give ourselves the window to the bank holiday weekend to open. So that was the journey in terms of time frame. It was loose conversations beginning of training September 19, then me taking the franchise on in January 2020, and then us opening obviously in May 2021.
Good. And here we are today. So yes, you've personally done a lot of the building work then yourself. Like, I know you said it was a bit difficult with materials being a bit scarce, but how was that? Like, have you done that sort of thing before?
Yes and no, in that the house that we've got needed quite a lot of work, but it was fairly cosmetic work. So obviously I got plasterers in to do the plastering, plumbers to do the plumbing, that kind of thing naturally in the house. And I would just do little bits, mainly decorating, mainly a little bit of kind of improvised adaptation, because we don't like much kind of contemporary built-in stuff. So we tended to repurpose old furniture and turn it into something that we want. So I'd done a little bit, but nothing. I mean, the thing that I've learned through DIY is that mostly, although people say a bad tradesperson blames their tools, actually the tools make the difference. If you've got the right tools, most things are possible. But tools are really expensive. So I kind of began it and got myself a decent set of basic tools, which allowed me to do most of the manual work myself. A lot of it was labor. It was literally just knocking things out and removing things. But then it was the carpentry, I suppose, of building back. And because of cost, what I tried to do is I tried to recycle as much of the materials as I could. So when I'd ripped out timbers, I kept those timbers and then I reused them. And obviously every timber was slightly different. They weren't all uniform 2x2s, 2x3s, 4x2s, whatever. I then found a recycling wood yard in Walker, Newcastle, which was amazing because it was it was recycling old timbers like I was doing, but they had all the kind of raw materials that you needed in terms of floor timbers and things like that as well. And they were so much cheaper than going to a builder's yard. But again, they would have five of when I needed eight. So I would take five and then I would take another seven of a hodgepodge and kind of try and cobble together. So I also felt as though I was learning on the job how to do things, but it wasn't as if I was like going to a builder's merchant saying, right, I need this and they're all perfect. I was then actually almost bespoking everything as I went, which I loved. And I feel quite proud of what I managed to achieve. And there's some things that probably nobody notices in the studio, but me, that if I had my time again, to be fair, there's only about one or two things that if I had my time again, I would do differently. But on balance, I'm really pleased with what we managed to achieve, but it was a massive learning process. And it involved quite a lot of time on the phone, ringing people to say, well, how do I do that? And you get 10 different responses from 10 different people. So some of it was learning who to trust and when just to be pigheaded and just have a go and see if it would work.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I suppose it gives you a total sense of pride, the fact that you've managed to do that. And it is a lovely space. So you should be really proud of yourself.
Thank you.
I know it's early days, but so far, like, what's your experience of working as a franchisee? How have you found it?
Well, I think the reason that we took on the franchise was twofold. One was because obviously we both had good jobs with decent salaries. We're slightly older. We've got four kids between us and we've still got mortgages and things like that. So we needed something that was financially viable, and yoga studios per se are not particularly viewed as
a license to print money, nor is yoga instructing, as you would know yourself, you know, and yeah, many of the listeners will be familiar with. And the risk of taking on a studio and all that brings means that people who do that, you know, hats off to them. Yeah, they have to be really visionary and brave, or lucky and have some kind of financial float mechanism, which we didn't really have. So we were drawn to the franchise in terms of the fact that there was already like a really well-established model that looked like it worked from a financial viability point of view. And I think when we started to do the teacher training initially and got to meet some of the crew, we kind of realized that Hot Pod, although it's kind of regarded as the biggest yoga brand in Europe, and the number of studios it's got around, is still actually really very small and personable, with a really strong support team in London who prioritize the franchise process. So as franchisees, it really felt quite quickly like you were really looked after, but also you tapped into the expertise of like digital media, finance, buildings, everything there. So although you pay a price for the franchise, very quickly we felt as though, God, if we hadn't had that, I don't know how we would have done that. It would have instantly cost us £2,000-£4,000 in consultancy on somewhere else that we got as part of the franchise. So I think the franchise gave us peace of mind that if things weren't kind of going as we would hoped, that there was always a network there that they would say, what about this? Have you thought about that? And give you that support, even just down to the fact that, you know, Hot Pod as a brand, we fell in love with. So that's a key factor. You know, the hot yoga, the benefits that gave Ali particularly, was like, well, this is something really different worth kind of investing in. But also the uniqueness of the pod, which Nick and Max kind of created, is not to be, obviously they've got the patent for it, but if you look around globally, that was quite a landmark step forward, something that rightly should be protected through a patent, but it gives that flexibility of hot yoga in more or less any reasonable size studio space without having to fully insulate a space, heat all day and all night, all of those things. And add into that the branding of that lovely scent that you'll be familiar with, the fact that we've got nice music, which we kind of source from unsigned artists locally, that Nick himself kind of curates on a monthly basis with somebody, with a local DJ. So the philosophy of Hot Pod is very local and sustainable, but also with a keen eye on, this is still a business. We need to be able to pay our yoga teachers the best price that they can get anywhere. And we need our customers to feel like it's a unique brand and that they're getting something special and different when they walk through the door. So those are the things that drew us to it. And, you know, as a central team, that hasn't disappointed me in terms of the support that we've had from them to date. It's been brilliant. It's been absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, I don't know what we would have done if we'd set up our own studio. I don't know where we'd be. My gut feeling is there's no way we would have hit the ground running as quickly as I feel like we have done. I'm not saying that that's impossible to generate your own lovely independent yoga studio, because I think it absolutely is, but certainly the risk is higher and our stage of life, I think that's something that we probably was a risk too far for us to take.
I understand. Thanks for sharing that with us. So can you remember your first yoga session and what was it like? Was it in a hot pod? Like, where were you?
Oh God, no. The honest answer is no, but I can explain probably my first kind of yoga experiences that I do recall. So one was in Whitley Bay. I think this is probably my second yoga experience in some respects, where I looked into what yoga was available after becoming aware of yoga, probably through the fact that I surf, and an awareness that there'd been some people saying about yoga being beneficial for surfers. And I found a yoga, I won't say a studio, but like a yoga class in Whitley Bay that I attended. I think I probably went a few times. Looking back in hindsight, it was probably largely yin, restorative style yoga. It was the classic, what you would imagine, which is not to disparage it, but it was kind of an older white lady with kind of hippie trousers and incense burning. And as a young kind of lad going independently, felt like, is this an environment that I feel comfortable in? I wanted to experiment and try it, but did I feel like it was the space for me? And having all the hang-ups that I probably did as a 20-year-old boy, you know, at that time. But I really enjoyed it, I'm naturally an open person, so I hope that I don't ever come across as having any preconceptions or judgment on types of people. I've loved that aspect of teaching and feel like I can generally get on with anybody. But it kind of looked like how you would imagine yoga to be at the time. And I'm not sure that that fit perfectly with me. And also the style of yoga was that relaxing style rather than an element of a bit more of a physical challenge too. And then I got back in the days, as unfortunately you'll probably remember, Jules, but maybe some of the listeners won't, is that I was aware of like a yoga for surfers video, I think advertised somewhere. So I bought that and it came in the post, obviously. And I remember putting this VHS video on that had little 15-minute sequences of quite a famous surfer at the time doing yoga with an instructor that I then used to follow. It was just like a post-surf stretch out at a pre-surf kind of energize, that type of thing. And I really enjoyed that and felt like I could really see the difference when I was surfing, either before or after, that I felt more kind of limber afterwards. The stiffness that I had or any kind of antagonistic stresses that I'd picked up from surfing eased faster. So I became quite reliant on that sequence, but it was only like two or three 15-minute sequences. But in hindsight, what I also noticed is that it was probably quite poorly instructed because there were certain postures in that were thrown in that beginner yoga session, like camel, which I used to do. And then every time I did that yoga, I thought, God, I'm really hurting my back here. That's supposed to help, but this is really hurting me.
Yeah.
And obviously where I've gone in my journey now, I felt like there was some really significant missing cues in how it's set up going into that posture that weren't there. So I kind of had that sensation that this is really right for me, but obviously at the same time, you have to be careful with it because potentially you can, if you do things the wrong way, cause yourself more harm than good. So those are my first experiences, I suppose. And then as I traveled more with surfing, invariably that kind of surf culture, yogi culture came hand in hand. One of the most kind of prolific surf destinations is Indonesia, and Bali being the hub of that. So obviously you can't probably throw a stick without hitting a yogi or a surfer in Bali. So invariably we would go back to Bali and do some yoga classes when I was there, or stay at a place that had a shala and try lots of different types of yoga. And then I think as Ali and I took on headship, we were doing it more and feeling the physical benefits in terms of keeping us able to manage the kind of challenges of the job, but more mentally, giving ourselves that time to and space to relax and feel more confident in yourself. And then we came back from places like Bali and felt we just moved from kind of Whitley Bay. Ali had relocated from Sussex and then we'd up to me in Whitley Bay. And then we wanted a place of our own. We'd got like together. So we'd moved up to Camas, just in Northumberland. And basically it felt as though there wasn't much available. So we were having to travel to do yoga. So we found the Ashington Leisure Centre, did a couple of yoga classes a week. And that's where we found the amazing Marta, who's one of our instructors, and really gave us hope that that there was other teachers out there that we could connect with. And then we went to my kids, when they're not with me, are with their mum in Whitley Bay still. So Hot Pod opened a Whitley Bay branch. So we noticed that. And when I started dropping the kids off on a Wednesday night, we started to go to Hot Pod. And that was like when the penny drops, was like, right, we can really do this regularly. So at that time, we were kind of dipping between Hot Pod sessions in Whitley Bay, Ashington Leisure Centre, and any other classes that Marta did, because she ran some of the classes around Northumberland. There's a local studio in Morpeth as well that we used to go to as well for some of the classes, and all fitting that in and around headship. Feeling that increasingly was really important for our mental and physical well-being, for it to be part of our regular practice. So that's the journey in yoga, I suppose. It wasn't direct. It wasn't a sudden epiphany where I fell in love with it at 20 and suddenly thought, this is the journey. I think it's always been in the background, but it's just increasingly become more and more relevant as I physically got older and felt the need for a different diet of exercise around my surfing or other sports that I've done variously. And more importantly, I suppose, mentally, that what you get from that meditation, even if even if you don't call it meditation, that state of mindful flow that you reach when you're practicing, particularly, I think, with vinyasa. And also, I kind of feel partly, particularly with hot yoga, because the heat gives up that level of distraction. You just give over everything else apart from focusing on the flow. And in doing so, I feel as though you reach that mindful state more readily, which makes you feel as though you've had a separate mental release through that practice as well.
Yes.
There was a lot to take in there, wasn't there?
No, it was a lot to take in.
Oh, you did ask.
I asked. This is good. I did want to touch on a little bit more about your surfing. But just before that, like, take me back, because you were born in Zambia, right? Is that right?
That's right.
Like, how did that happen? I know you were just, you know, you were born, so we know how that happens. But it's a bit of an odd place for you to be now in. Well, I don't know. Just tell me about it.
I think it's one of those things. I mean, the irony is, coincidentally, when I was at university, I ended up staying in a house with another lad who came from Durham. I didn't know him from Adam, who, when we were talking, he was born in Zambia too. He's the same age as me. And like, I feel as though at that time, maybe there was, like, from an industry point of view, that variously England had outposts around the world, where they had businesses, and obviously people variously got sent there. So at that time, my mum and dad had been working in Manchester, I think. My dad's from Barnsley, Yorkshire. My mum's from up here, from Whitley Bay. And when they met and got married, they moved variously from here and then to Manchester to work. And the company that my dad was working for, basically, it's a battery firm. And he was the technical director there, and they needed him to go to Zambia to work on the battery plant that was presumably over there as a base. I'm guessing it must have been maybe something to do with the resources. And he was posted out there for a period of time. So my mum went, and she was pregnant with me. So I was born over there. And then while they were there, so there's pictures of me in like a silver cross pram and kind of white lacy 70s, you know, baby garb, overlooking Victoria Falls. I can't remember any of it. But strangely, I'm the only one in the family who tans. Everybody else, you know, turns beetroot at the first sign of sunshine, but I am quite comfortable in the sun and really like the heat. So I wonder whether that's got something to do with it, that exposure I had rolling around in an old-fashioned terry toweling nappy in the sun for the first 10 months of my life. And then obviously at that point, my mum was expecting my brother, and basically felt like it was a better environment to give birth in the UK than in Zambia. It's been a while since I talked to my mum about these stories, but I'm sure that when I was born, obviously the local community is different in Zambia. And at the time I got seen by the local witch doctor and just to be checked out and blessed and all that kind of stuff. So, he didn't have that experience. He was just in the RVI. But my mum, I think, felt a bit more secure coming back to the UK. So my dad stayed there and my mum came back to give birth to my son. It was that different time, wasn't it? My dad was just telling me the other day how they'd had to, the sister in the ward where my mum had given birth had said, you must get your husband to ring from Zambia because everybody thinks you're an unwed mother because we haven't seen a man because she was by herself here. So my dad had to ring from Zambia. And then when he was just telling me the other day that could you tell my children, so that you had to ring on the operator, had to book the operator's call, make the call, and then they would put the call through the hospital, and the lady on the phone in the hospital said, you're not calling from Zambia. And at that time, the operator was always on the line listening to the call, and the African lady intervened with obviously quite a strong African accent and said, he is calling from Africa. at that point, the lady went and got me mum so that she could prove that she wasn't an unwed mother, and that actually she was talking to her husband who'd fathered her child. So it must have been a funny few years for them, I think, as well. And for my mum to do that alone, to kind of come back on a flight from Zambia with a 10-month-old and, you know, 7 months pregnant, eight months pregnant. So that's where I was born, but I don't remember any of it, but I've obviously got loads of photos of me at that period of time. So I'm sure it will have shaped me in some shape or form very differently from my brother and sister, but. And then when we got back, we fairly quickly moved to the coast, to Whitley Bay, where my mum and dad still are and I have been ever since. And then obviously they had my brother and my sister, you know, fairly quickly after that. And we stayed locally there, and I've been here ever since, I suppose, other than when I've been at university or traveling.
That's so interesting. And I also read that you were really into like competitive sports as a child. Is that right? Like you've always, I know you talked about surfing, but you've been quite sporty in general. Like one of the sports, you were into pole vaulting. Like how do you even start pole vaulting?
You start with ballet. That's where you start. I think it's basically that the fact that I was naturally, I suppose, good at sports. I enjoyed different sports. My mum, I think, and dad always wanted to give me those opportunities. My mum's ballet mad. And when I was really young, she forced me and my brother to go to ballet. It had the added benefit of when I was going to primary school and I had itchy trousers, I could put my ballet tights on under my trousers, but nobody knew. And obviously, boys didn't do ballet at that time. But I think, and I remember my brother and I going to performances at Whealy Bay Playhouse, which if you're like some of the listeners might be local, might know it, but it was amazing because we were probably like 5 and 6 and around us was all these like 15, 16 year old dancers. We were in heaven. We thought it was amazing just rocking out with these girls all the time. But we did that ballet to start, and then we started school. And I think as a result of that, I went to a school in Desmond, and it was one of the decisions my parents made to send us to private school. My mum was in education. She was a teacher too. And undoubtedly, lots of people have very mixed views on independent schools. And I ended up working in state education for all my career, being a state head. There's benefits and disadvantages to with the independent sector, and there's probably not anything we want to get into in the podcast because it'll take us a long, long time. But certainly one of the benefits of that private schooling is that you've got lots of opportunities for sport. So I got there and we did lots of sports at school, and naturally I appear to be quite good at gymnastics. So quite quickly there was a club there, and then that was associated with like a regional squad in Ashington, of all places, actually, at the time. It was run by a former bodybuilder. So I kind of branched quite quickly from school gymnastics, where you did national competitions, obviously, because of the nature of the school I went to, and we had a good squad. Then I kind of developed into, I don't know how, I can't really recall how it works, but like regional gymnast to the point where I was on like the national squad at about, I don't know, 9, 10 years old, something like that. I went down to Lillishaw, which I believe is still the national hub for gymnastics. And I remember having training camps down there, but it was at that age when my mum and dad had the conversation with the coaches to say, if he starts training properly at this age, then we'll look at like proper, you know, Commonwealth level championships, that kind of stuff. Or he doesn't. There's kind of no in between. You've either got to start training 7 days a week or not. And at that time, I was still probably 9, 10, 11, something like that. Mm. And I think they thought it was too much too young. I was doing other things, playing the piano, playing rugby and swimming at school as well. So they kept it quite broad and we said no. And obviously I always had that gymnastics in my background. And then school-wise, we did athletics as well, which I was naturally quite good at, but not as strong as other, like as what I led to become, which was the pole vault, because there was always a national competition in the schools where you got points for achievement in the sports. And the highest pointing one was always the pole vault because nobody ever bloody did it. So the head of PE looked at me and my gymnastics background and basically said, have a go at that. And they got a coach in. For not just me, but a few of the people. And obviously I just kind of took to it with the background I'd had from the gymnastics and quite quickly started training with Morpeth Harriers, actually. But we used to train at Gateshead Stadium. And it was the time, I suppose, around the era, if you remember Jonathan Edwards, the triple jumper?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so I used to train at Gateshead Stadium with that kind of crew. And we just pushed each other really hard, all of us around there. We worked really hard. We loved it. And I think from about the age of 13 to 17 odd, I was probably like for my age at that point, you're like under 14, under 15, under 16. I was the you know, consistently the top ranked pole vaulter in the country, and then had various national titles and eventually got a schoolboy England best for pole vaulting. It was an England, Scotland, Ireland, Wales kind of event, which was lovely because I've still got an England tracksuit hanging in the closet. And then I think, on top of that, being at that school, I was playing first team rugby and doing kind of national swimming competitions with that as well. So my life was just totally competitive sport. And I was really kind of ambitious in that way. I loved winning. But the athletics became, because pole vaulting was so niche, if I turned up at any competition locally, people used to get pissed off at me. They were like, you know, oh God, he's here. I can't, like, what's the point? He's just going to win. Now that's quite deflating because it's like you're training really hard and then there's no challenge, but also people don't like you.
Yeah.
So it's quite an individual sport. And then if I went to a national stage, I would get there and everyone would be like, he's the one to win. But I would be then like, right, it's mine to lose. A bit like, I mean, I'm not going to compare myself to Simone Biles at this moment in time, but I think that idea of the pressure of expectation that you're always the best. And I was probably starting to fall out of love with that sensation.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the time, I'd been coaching lots of sport, doing summer camps. And I kind of just started surfing one summer with a few pals. We were just messing around at the beach because we lived at the beach. And it just really took to it. And I felt quite humbled by the sea that I wasn't very good at it. And the fact that there was people there who I could see as a little tight-knit crew in Tynemouth who loved it and were far better than me and had clearly been doing it for years. And it kind of felt nice that I wasn't great. And it gave me permission, I think. And this is probably, it's quite aligned with, I suppose, the spirit of yoga, but it kind of taught me a lesson in that you don't have to be the best. It's just about how you feel about your effort. Mm. And I didn't need to win because I kind of looked at that scenario and thought, I'm not as good as them. And I can't see really a way in which I'm going to become as good as them. And I think that really tapped into my emotional well-being and thought, that feels good. That kind of feels better than walking around every day thinking you've got to be the best and everybody is out to get you and beat you. So I kind of was drawn more and more to that surfing, which I think will always upset my dad particularly because he had been a really strong athlete when he was younger and swimmer, and he'd injured himself badly, which had kind of stopped that. And I think he, as many parents often do, lived a bit vicariously through that and wanted me to go on and could imagine me at the Olympics and all that kind of stuff. But I got to that transition point of kind of schoolboy to senior level, which is much more difficult anyway. And I think I just took the fact that I'm loving the surfing. I'm starting to fall out of love with this athletics. And the competitive edge to it. And I also want to start seeing the world and, you know, traveling. So it took me down a different route, which allowed me to explore the world and go to lots of amazing places with the vehicle of surf and step away from that competitive kind of nature that I've got and kind of embrace the humility of that you get from surfing, pushing yourself against, a completely really immersive but natural form of energy that is almost indescribable in terms of how complex it is to figure out. The parameters change every time. So that became a complete addiction and still is to this day. As you well know, because we're recording this, having me let you down because we agreed to be in the studio and for the first time in 2 months, there was some surf and I got the 10-3 this morning to drive down to North Yorkshire and stays to get 2 hours of really good quality surf in the Northeast before I came back to teach. So it's still, as a 46-year-old, it's still driving me to get up at 10-3 in the morning and go to those lengths just for one surf. So it's an amazing sport, but I think that has really coupled in with the yoga now as I've got older to kind of balance out those initial qualities as I had as a competitive athlete. I took a lot of benefit from that. Don't be fooled. You know, I can still do a handstand in the pod, some people might regard, although it is completely not important at all, as good yoga practice, but it's just a load of nonsense. Just the fact that I've been doing handstands since I was 7. And I just remember how to do it. Do you know what I mean? It's not because I'm particularly Zen or a developed yogi. There's loads wrong with my practice, but that's what yoga is, isn't it? It's always a journey of self-improvement.
Exactly. And just touching a bit more on the surfing, like you said, it gave the opportunity to travel. Like, how did that opportunity present itself then?
Well, I kind of, when I first graduated from university, as many people do, I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. My mum, as I said, has always taught. And she was always like, you'd be a great teacher. I'd done coaching like forever in sports. And obviously everybody knew me locally as this for my sporting kind of achievements. And I came back from university not knowing what I wanted to do, but I just knew I wanted to go traveling, but I needed money. And literally my old head of PE, again, this is the downside, although I benefited from it, of kind of independent schooling, is my old director of PE rang me and said the little feeder prep school across the road needs a head of PE. They've been currently doing it with the headmaster, who used to be a professional footballer and a senior master, but they're too busy now. They need somebody independently to do PE. Are you interested? And I was like, no. And my mum was like, you need the money and you'd be good at it. Just go and speak to him. And basically I went and had a look around this school, walked out after about an hour and a half. And he just said, just let me know. And I said to my mum, I said, I think I've just been offered a job, like haven't put in a CV or any, you know what I mean? And at the time it was like, well, I'm going to get a salary and I can start saving money to go traveling. So it was like, it was always going to be temporary because my friends had left university and gone back to do MBAs and they're all going to finance and living the life down in London, which I felt was, I had a real chip on my shoulder about being a teacher. And basically they went off and I kind of taught for 3 years at this little prep school and I had my pals from sport who were helping me as teaching assistants. I was loving it. I was good at it. And you know, I was teaching the footballers kind of kids. So my first, I'd always played rugby. I'd never played football. I had two left feet really. And the two teachers who'd appointed me, actually, they were former pro footballers. Like one of them had played against Cruyff at the New Camp. He played like in the old Premiership in the first division. And the other one had played for Sunderland. And their touch was amazing. But I had to teach football. So I used to try and learn off them. But I also had to referee games. And my very first game of football with another side that came in, I think it was Hereworth Private School that we were playing. But I had Peter Beardsley's son on the pitch and Peter on the sidelines. I don't know if you know. I don't know if you know who Peter Beardsley is.
I know who Peter Beardsley is. I'm old enough to know that.
And I was absolutely terrified. I thought, I have no idea what I'm doing. If it was rugby, it'd be fine. I don't even know what the rules are. And at one point, somebody went down in the box. Like, these are like 8-year-olds, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't particularly important. And I blew the whistle and I thought, I don't know why I blew the whistle. Was that a foul? Wasn't it a foul? What do I do? Do I give a penalty? And I thought, Peter Beardsley's watching. But he was lovely. He was very gracious, actually. He was always a lovely supporter of the school. Unlike Davy Ginola, he used to just swan in and try and impress all the mums. He gave, I think, all the teachers a signed copy of his autobiography for Christmas.
Really?
Yeah. But so I did that for 3 years, earned the money, and then left to go, did what a lot of people do, obviously, got a round-the-world ticket to go to lots of different surf destinations at that time, intent on coming back and doing something different. And I think when I was away, what I noticed was a lot of people asked me, what's it like to teach? I've thought about teaching. And I kind of suddenly at that point thought, you know what? I've enjoyed it, but and maybe it's me that's got a chip on my shoulder about it. I felt like it wasn't really respected. So I think that I worked through that. And when I came through, I realized that actually teaching was a good thing to do, but because I wasn't in the competitive sport world anymore, and surfing was my thing, I felt like I was a bit of a sham being a PE teacher, even though I knew I was good at it. But my degree had been obviously really physical based and we'd done human dissection and things. So I kind of, science has always been there as a love and a curiosity anyway. So I had the ability to qualify as a science teacher. And actually from that point forwards, I absolutely loved teaching science and still find it fascinating, obviously. As I moved through the profession of being a teacher, do you know what I mean? The science was always the root of, like, you know, one of the most important subjects in the school and just generally for people's awareness about how life works and the awe and wonder that you find within that subject, you know? So I'm so pleased that I actually came back into it. But at that point, I went back into state education and remained there throughout my kind of professional teaching career as a science biology teacher. Going all the way through. But I think the question, I've gone off a bit, haven't I? So the question was about, was it about traveling?
Yeah, it was just about traveling and surfing and where, like, well, you answered it really. You said you had a round the world ticket and went to like all over the place. I didn't know whether you had just a certain destination in mind or it sounds like you did just a lot of traveling all around.
I have generally, because on the holidays either side of that, I've kind of pinpointed places that are on the surfing to-do list that I've always wanted to go. I was quite lucky in that I got to a stage after my first proper job, my first like the science teacher job, where I'd been there about 3 or 4 years. And I really wanted to do the Hawaii thing, you know, but Hawaiian waves, which are the bigger waves, and everybody kind of has that. It's probably shifted a bit now to when I was first started surfing, but Hawaii Hawaii was, you know, certainly always the mecca for big waves, challenging waves, and the reputation of being able to go somewhere and feel like you've experienced that. But obviously that's a winter playground. So you get 6 weeks off in the summer, but you only get 2 weeks at Christmas, and that's no good for Hawaii. So I kind of, I went to my boss at the time and said, look, I'm leaving. I'm leaving in January, and I'm going to Hawaii, and I love it here. And if you can't replace me, I'd be more than happy to come back. There's my resignation type of thing. I kind of played hardball for the first time in my life, actually. I was a bit like, I'm going. And that, you know, that joy of youth and not worrying so much about the consequences. And obviously knowing now what I do about head teachers, I was thinking, God, replacing a science teacher is a nightmare. So I actually, to be fair, they got their pound of flesh on me, because I actually wrote cover for 2 months, like I'd like lesson by lesson cover for all my classes that he was then going to pay somebody else to teach, and I didn't get paid for. And I left. So I had 2 months in Hawaii at one point as well, which was a real nice opportunity to be able to do. And I did the same with Mexico, places in Mexico that I wanted to go to, spent a couple of months there. Indonesia's like a hotspot for surfers. So I've kind of been variously through a lot of Indonesia. You're probably amounting to like a year's worth of time over there, I suppose, all in all, but mostly in Bali. But invariably, when I was younger and a bit freer, able to go to some of the lesser islands and kind of sleep on the beach in a under a board bag and a mozzie net, and kind of surf alone on empty beaches. So it's a luxury that surfing often takes you to places that are kind of beautiful and idyllic, but also a little bit far removed from the normal. So you tend to find spots that other people haven't discovered until they become really popular. And then what actually tends to happen is the surf culture drives tourist development, which you see in places like Bali particularly, but other plots around the world. So yeah, I've been very fortunate and really, really enjoy being able to travel and surf at the same time.
So you've mentioned Bali, Hawaii, Mexico. Now we're in the Northeast, and you went this morning to Yorkshire. Like that is a bit of a different kettle of fish from these amazing, stunning places, surely. Like, I mean, it's summer here now, but you're not talking tropical temperatures. So do you still go out on the Northeast coast in the winter? Is it just you, or is it actually, have you got friends that do this as well? And what, like, do you not get cold? I mean, it's not just cold, it's bloody freezing. How do you cope?
Yeah, but you've moved up here, haven't you? You're still soft. You haven't acclimatized yet. The answer is yes, 100%. And again, having had those opportunities of like surfing in these like world famous places, you know, there's probably, if you get lists of top 10 waves in the world, you know, there's probably a fair smattering of them that I've ticked off and spent time in. And I've had waves as good as those waves on the Northeast coast, you know, without a shadow of doubt. It's just cold, yes, and inconsistent, but when it happens, it's amazing. And what you don't get here is you don't tend to get huge amounts of crowds of people, which really messes up the wave experience, because you're fighting and it becomes really competitive. And can be quite ugly, actually, the surf scene in certain places around the world. So you don't have to compete with that. Wetsuits now are ever, ever better. So really the only kind of barrier there is cost, because they are also getting more and more expensive, but reasonably you're kind of, it's a one-off payment that will last you at least one or two seasons, and that you don't have to pay to go in the sea. So I kind of feel as though I'm a complete advocate. I think one of the things I did when I was traveling, particularly through New Zealand, Australia, I kind of thought like, well, I'm just going to figure out where I want to live here, because I'm never going home. Every time I went round to different places, I kind of was like, this doesn't feel quite right. And I don't quite know why. And it was a bit like, well, actually everybody in Australia surfs, it's not special. And actually, although it's warm, invariably the waves 90% of the time are fairly mediocre. They're just more consistent, a bit like Cornwall. Everybody thinks of Cornwall in the UK as being this like hot spot for surfing, but actually half of at Swansea, the southwest, were up at Yorkshire this morning because they traveled all the way up for this one day swell, because they know how good the waves are in the northeast. On any given day that the waves are good in the northeast, there'll be pro surfers from Cornwall who've come up, because the quality that we have here is genuinely world class. It's just, you have to wait for it, so you have to keep yourself fit and ready for it when it's on, and you have to have the right equipment because it is cold. But the benefit you get from that is that you're usually just alone with a handful of your friends, and obviously, there isn't any, to our knowledge, of those things, any great big hungry sharks that are going to eat you, like some of many of the other hot spots that makes you worry and again adds to that kind of experience. And I think I always used to liken it to that familiarity, that if you've got something that's okay every day, you'll get bored of it. If you've got something that's amazing, but it's few and far between, you live for that. It drives that sensation of, lust's a funny word, but you know what I mean? You kind of lust for those windows. And that's why, as Ali just joked to you before about like everything gets dropped when a good swell comes. Now that's not entirely true. Now I'm at my ripe old age and I've got kids and responsibilities. You just can't do that, but it's not easy. It's not easy to not do that, because you kind of still stomp your feet like a toddler thinking, like, I remember mum saying, oh, there'll be other days, there'll be other waves. And I'm thinking, no, there won't. That waves that just coming through now are 100% unique and will never break on the shore again. That they just won't. And any surfer will tell you the same thing. You know, that, you know, each swell is different. You can remember individual swells for years and years and years and years. And it's a very special feeling. And the Northeast Coast is a really, I mean, it's gaining that reputation in like real surfers in the UK are fully aware of it. But just generally from a lifestyle point of view, it's definitely seeing an explosion. I mean, I'm glad I don't live Whitley Bay, Tynemouth Way anymore for the reasons that the local beaches are just getting busier and busier and busier. And as a result of that, quite often you'll see people who are just frustrated that there's too many people in the water, and then people get hurt, people get frustrated. But it's because people are coming to it knowing that it makes you feel good. Being out in nature, that's what it is about. You're doing three things that everybody will know will improve your mental health. One, physically exercising. Two, being out in nature and really, really connected to nature, not just like out in it, but literally in it. Yeah. And you get all that environment that associate with that. You know, you'll see the dolphins up closer than you would from the shore, all that kind of stuff. And also the focus that you need when you're in that kind of moment and of contemplation, watching the waves, is, you know, is basically meditation. It's my form of meditation, I suppose. You distract yourself from all other chatter that's going on in the mind and only give that singularity. And because you're not surfing all the moments, the gaps between those waves, your brain is having those meditative moments. And people appreciate that and are starting to realize that, God, I feel really good after that. I feel hammered. I feel like I've been put through the tumble dryer or whatever, and I'm tired. And it's hard, because it is. But you reach that sense of flow and connectivity with nature. So, you know, it's a brilliant sport to be doing. And the Northeast Coast is a fabulous place to do it. Plus, it's beautiful. The Northeast Coast is amazing. It's got that stark comparison as well in certain areas between industrial bleakness and, you know, pristine white beaches and isolation. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. Wow. We don't want to tell everybody though, because they'll all be coming up here.
I think they are.
I have.
I think they mostly are in lockdown. Yeah. But it's like, I think that's a difficult thing about life, is that, you know, we share the good things. Like, I worry sometimes about like social media. Like, everybody has worries about things like social media, but everyone's like, well, it's fake, you know, we shouldn't always just be sharing our best side. And I'm thinking, well, that's exactly what social media is for. It's for sharing your best side. Like, you share the crap side with people you're close and near to. But if anybody's got an ounce of sensibility, they should be able to realize that social media is the good stuff and take it and not assume that that is life. And I think some of the work we've got to do is learning that people can embrace the good stuff and use it as a filter for inspiring and taking things forward, rather than always just like necessarily being down on that. You know, I mean, until I opened the studio as a head teacher, I had a really small social media footprint. But the only things I would ever post were things when the surf was really good, or that there was an amazing sunrise, or the house. And I know we live in a really lovely place, but I wanted to share that, but I didn't want to share that to piss people off and think, oh, there he goes again, he's just sharing all the good stuff. It's like, well, this is really good, enjoy it. If you don't want to enjoy it, then mute me, but I'm not going to share you the bad stuff, because I don't want to make you feel bad. It's my burden, and I'll talk to you if I need to. I think that's one of the nice things about maybe the pandemic is allowing people to start to connect with the good stuff and realize what actually is good stuff, rather than which people are starting to realize is things like yoga, surfing, being outdoors, eating well, being healthy. You know what I mean? So, yeah. But we're going, I'm probably taking you way off piece. Sorry.
No. It's really interesting insight, especially because the way that you described how you were surfing, there was massive parallels for me between how you described your yoga experience and your surf experience. They seem to be quite similar, like language. And do you draw big parallels as well? Is that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I find that, I've done lots and lots of exercise and I love exercise, but I'm also quite fickle. I like new experiences. So I feel as though to hold my attention, something has to be quite unique and give me something more than just like activity. And what I think is different with yoga that you also get with surfing and some of the things is there's culture there and history, which is fascinating. There is a deeper sense of connectivity. So for me, yoga, like you can spend hours looking at philosophy of yoga and I'm not sure I would be a really good, I wouldn't be able to well articulate the philosophy and culture of yoga to other people. I don't know it well enough to do that. So I try and simplify it for my own mind really, because it's been bastardized and evolved over millennia anyway. So what one person thinks is yoga will be entirely different to what somebody else thinks is yoga. So from that point of view, I feel like yoga should have the freedom for people to be able to kind of take from it what they think it is. So for me, that sense of it being just to yoke and unite is just the simple idea of knowing your mind and body. And what I find is when you practice yoga, then you get that connectivity, because the asanas that you move through teach you about your body if your mind is engaged with that. And then when you work through different problems, situations, whatever, you'll invariably have those moments in your practice where you either find peace or you find struggle or your mind drifts off somewhere else and you bring it back. But it's kind of concentrated through your practice, so that at the end of that time, when you get that amazing shavasana, you can kind of distill a little bit of those sensations. And I've not really found another form of, let's use that word, exercise, you know what I mean, just as a parallel comparison, that gives you anywhere like that. And surfing does it in a different way, but it's obviously not designed as such, it's a byproduct.
Okay, so Peter, I also need to make sure I ask you in this interview, because it's quite a big deal, I think, your house. I mean, you touched on it earlier, you live on the beach, and the little bits I've seen on Insta, it looks proper stunning. But I also heard that it's going to be appearing in Good Homes magazine soon, which is absolutely amazing. Like, that's not just a nice house, that's like a stunning house that people kind of, you know, feel like they want to, not envious, but like, you know, it's an aspirational home, isn't it? An inspiring home. So how did that opportunity come about? And is it all right?
Well, I think it's, there's the thing with magazines, to be fair, is that they, a bit like we were talking before about social media, they kind of present like what you think other people want, maybe.
Yeah.
But underneath that, if you scratch the surface, what can you see that actually isn't perfect? But I think the thing is, Ali had lived in predominantly for a long period of time in kind of East Sussex countryside and then Rye, but all obviously beautiful parts of the country, and moved up here to Whitley Bay. And I had a nice house I was happy with, but it felt quite, I think, claustrophobic for Ali in terms of the space around the house, because it was, you know, Whitley Bay's a busy place. So you're kind of cheek by jowl with lots of other people. So I think we both felt like we wanted a fresh start with a house that was ours rather than one of us moving into the other's house.
You know? Yeah.
And in some respects, finding property in the Northeast is quite tricky, because there's a real stark divide between, there isn't really any country until you get into Northumberland. And then obviously things are really wet, like miles out of the way. So we kind of struggled for a while. We looked at houses all over the place, down as far as Seaham, because we were looking for basically something that was close to the sea for me to surf, because I'm never going to give up the beach, but also that had that sense of space and countryside. And we, you know, as people buying a new house together, starting again almost, there was cost implications. We didn't, although we had decent jobs, we couldn't afford a lot of the houses that you would tend to find in that kind of price bracket. I mean, if you go to Whitley Bay Tynemouth, you can get a lovely house that overlooks the sea, but there's no space, there's no garden, and they're, you know, a lot of money for what they are. So they were kind of off the books straight away just for my price, but also we kind of thought, well, that's not really what we want. Yeah. Whereas if you go somewhere that's got lots of space and is cheap, then it tends to be quite pokey or in the middle of nowhere or whatever else. So we kind of were struggling. And then interestingly, I saw the pictures of this property online and I disregarded it, because if any of the listeners know of Camas, it's kind of, it's a bit of a strange place that's been largely forgotten, partly because nobody knows how to say it, because it's spelled Cambois, as in, like, it sounds French.
It does. I thought it was like framboise. So when I first moved, I was like, oh, yes, Cambois. Yes. And people are like, no, it's just Camas. Oh, Camas. Okay.
Which I believe, I think, is from early times when it was Roman, when the spelling of the area was called C-A-M-U-S. But anyway, that might be just what was written on the pub wall. That might not be true. I don't know. But I kind of had gone into that beach. It's like a forgotten beach. It wasn't particularly regarded for surf, but it's tucked away. So you drive past what is now like the north side of the port of Blyth, which is quite industrial and derelict at the time, and an old power station, which has been knocked down, which obviously looks quite derelict. And there's old train tracks. So the train's kind of delivering stuff from the port. So it's got a real gritty kind of Get Carter feel to that part of the beach. And I'd driven into that part of the beach to check the surf, thought the surf wasn't great, and driven back out again. So when I saw these pictures online, I thought, Ali's not going to want to live there. It's kind of too full on. And plus the pictures were so odd. Normally when you sell a house, you take the best possible pictures, don't you?
Yeah.
But these pictures made the house look much more set back from the sea, and really, like, they just didn't do it justice, basically.
Yeah.
And so I kind of disregarded it. And then about a week later, Ali found it independently and was like, what about this place? Never heard about this. It's right by the beach and it's got loads of space around it. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure you'll really like it, but let's go and have a look anyway. We didn't order a viewing. We just literally drove to the house. And
what happened? The old drive-by.
We drove to the house and started driving past the bits I knew. And it was like, where is it? Oh, it's not here. And we kept going up the beach. And then you get to the end of the beach where the pub is and the car park. And then you kept going. It's like, I've never been to this part of the beach. Then all of a sudden the beach is like white sand, pristine, like grassy banks. And then you get to the mouth of the Wansbeck. There's this cute little boat harbor. And it's like, there's the house. It's like, and we suddenly were like, well, one, you can't really drive down there because it's like a boat harbor. So as soon as we drove down there, it was like one of those operations, like where you drive past a house, it's like, oh my God, they know that we're looking at a house, which I do now because people drive in front of the house all the time. They drive down the road, they get in front of the house when they can just see the sea because it comes out from the neighbor's property. Yeah. And then they stop to look at the view. And I'm always stood in the window thinking, do you know what you're doing? What the next thing you're going to be turning around in my drive, which they do.
Yeah.
And go back because they know they can't get down to the boat harbour.
Yeah.
So we kind of did that and it was like, oh, this is very different. It's not what we expected. And I think a lot of people, certainly at that time, this is about 4.5, 5 years ago now, would have naturally looked at Camas and just thought, no way, not interested at all. Just because of the reputation of the area is basically fairly forgotten and neglected. But as soon as we saw that, we thought, well, it's definitely worth a look. But it had that conundrum of the house needs quite a lot doing to it, but also because the area is a little bit neglected, like how will it feel living there? Will you feel a million miles away from anywhere else? And once we looked around the house, it was just like the house had so much potential, a bit like the studio. Then the previous owners had basically bought it 14 years ago, never done anything with it. It had been done up to sell at that point. So it just kind of just gone kind of really bland beige and then like rotten. There'd been like roof leaks that they'd not fixed, which they said they'd fixed, but they hadn't. The place stank of damp.
Aww.
And I kind of, our gut feeling was these are all resolvable things, mostly cosmetic. Structurally, yeah. It's been there for over 100 years. So we could see quite easily that we could do the work. And then we basically put in the offer for a while, and we kind of got gazumped and basically had our heart broken. Mm-hmm. And at that point found somewhere different. And then the people who'd gazumped us, they wanted to buy it. It was a London cash buyer as a holiday home, and they walked away. So they came back to us like cap in hand, and we were like a bit like if you're watching, you're probably not watching Love Island, but like
I am watching Love Island.
Liam going back to
Millie,
begging forgiveness, and they were like, and we were like, you've broken our hearts. That's it. We're not interested. We walked. We basically kind of were like, it's too painful. And then after a few weeks, we just kind of went for a walk on the beach, and we're just like, are we cutting our nose off to spite our face here? And then we kind of basically put in another counter offer and said, that's it. We've kind of lost a lot of variously through the process of selling our houses and waiting and all that kind of thing. Take it or leave it. So the house had been on the market for a long time, which again, raised us thinking, you know, what's it going to be like as a resale? You know, what's the area like? Why is nobody else interested? Because it's this amazing house.
Yeah.
And obviously we ended up having it. And then we just basically realized, one, how beautiful the house was, which you kind of knew. Two, how it felt relatively easy for us to make it really nice for us. We just have a fairly simple taste, but we just did everything quite naturally and found a few nice shops that kind of were in line with our style. And then the neighbors and the community is just beautiful, like without reservation. And we walk out barefoot down onto the sand, and I surf out front, and just, you know, you can go down, have a fire on the beach and a little picnic or a barbecue, and then run straight back into the shower. You know, it doesn't really matter what the weather's doing. And then out the back of the windows, you see you looking over the fields that adjoin the Wansbeck. And I just think a couple of things have happened. People like us moving there has inevitably raised the profile because we talk about it. So my friend who's a surfer, who's a removal van company, he did the removals, and he's like, how did you find this? I was like, well, it's always been here, you know. And then he lives in Tymouth, so obviously then he told it. Then the next people you see, you're like, oh, I've heard you live in a lovely house, and how did you find it? So, and the neighbors, there's a couple of families particularly who are really close, that have effectively, their houses have never been up for sale, so there's no price index really in the area. So mm-hmm. the last house to be bought and sold was ours. So it was really interesting because the nearest neighbors across the way, it was kind of derelict. They bought it from auction and have done a renovation themselves. So it's never been really listed and valued, but it's amazing. And then what used to be the land of our property was sold, and the other neighbors built from the ground up a brand new, really contemporary modern house, which is stunning. Like, it's a Marmite house. You know, what you notice is people walk down the road and they look at it, and some people say, can't believe they've allowed that to be built here.
Yeah.
Because it's more modern next to like really sandstone and old kind of cottagey houses. And other people look and say, that's amazing. It's all glass fronted at the top, and it's an upside down house with kind of views like spanning everywhere from the third floor. And more importantly, all those people are lovely, as are the people who just live down the road as well. So we tend to have really nice, we did before everything went weird, parties in each of our houses, and each house feels different, but also really nice.
Aww.
So I think we just felt lucky with it, and we really like it. And I think from a selfish point of view as well, starting a new business, you start to think, how can you make sure that people are aware of you as a business, and what can you do to raise the profile of the area, the place? And we'd seen somebody locally that we followed on Insta, and that we bought stuff from their shop, Glebe House Vintage, had done a photo shoot, and her house looked fab. And I just said to Ali, I said, should I just get in touch with the people who did the photo shoot and say, would you be interested in doing our house? So obviously they got back in touch, and they said, yeah, we'd love to. And then what they do is they take the photos and they go and kind of take them to different magazines to see who's interested. So we don't get any money or anything for it. I think the photographers, that's their job. But obviously we potentially, there'll be a comment in there about Hot Pod Yoga and Morpeth. So I kind of thought, if we can raise the profile and make people think that Camas is a nice place, we have no intention of moving ever. We didn't buy the house to kind of renovate it to sell to make money. That's not in our nature. You know, we just wanted a lovely place to live and we feel really lucky about it. So yeah, it's nice. We have breakfast every morning together in bed overlooking the sea. You know, we've seen dolphins from bed and it's just, we feel like entirely grateful for that opportunity. But at the same time, the house stood there for 2 years. Nobody else wanted it. So you kind of think sometimes it takes somebody. And then since then, obviously so many people say where you live looks amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether it looks amazing because it's a photograph on Insta or whether they would think it is amazing, but would they buy it? Would they live somewhere that isn't Jesmond or Gosforth or Morpeth? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Hang-ups. But what we feel is that we can jump in the car and in 25 minutes we're in Newcastle City Centre at a restaurant, or we're in Amble, or we're in Felton. So we kind of can get everywhere really easily and quickly. It feels in the middle of nowhere, but it's not.
Sounds like it's just perfect for what you were looking for when you set out in the search. So good on you.
Yeah, it was totally lovely. We can't wait to have a hot pod party there at some point.
Definitely. Not pick a nice day.
Yeah.
So exactly. What's next for you then, Peter?
I think obviously we've just been open 9 weeks now, so there's still a lot for us to kind of grow and build. This first year is going to be really interesting for us in terms of how it continues to build, how we develop kind of more classes, respond to the interests of the people locally. Beyond that, I think it's really difficult to say. You know, we'd originally thought about whether we would want to open another studio somewhere else in Northumberland. So that's kind of in the back of the minds, is that a possibility? I feel like we've got to get this one kind of secure first and also be a bit more knowledgeable, because Northumberland's a wonderful place, but it's not really high in terms of population. So that is the problem for a small business, that you need people, unfortunately, to pay your bills. So we would love to be able to kind of take the impact of the yoga that we do here to people who ordinarily wouldn't normally come into a yoga studio, or maybe even who couldn't afford to do it. But again, you've got to have the money to make a viable business before you can start to give that opportunity to people at something that isn't going to give to earn you a salary, because you can't, you know, we're not a charity, unfortunately. And we wouldn't be able to get that. So I think we want to try and expose as many people as possible to the experience. And in some ways, some of that will be about providing access to people who maybe ordinarily wouldn't be able to afford it. So that's one thing. We're getting older. So I don't know the transition. I mean, Ali is an amazing head teacher, but she loves the experience of the studio as well. So at some point, you know, could we embrace that wider education that we do personally, as well as the pod, in terms of retreat work or things associated with kind of life coaching, surfing, supping, like meditate, you know what I mean? That kind of lifestyle opportunity, because I think, you know, certainly both of us have got a variety of experiences from a strategic point of view, from an educational point of view, and from a lifetime point of view, that we could maybe tap into. But I think we've just got to find a way to enjoy what we're doing first and foremost, to make what we're doing right now successful. So no big, I'm not a 5-year plan type of person.
No.
So it seems quite strange that, you know, 18 months ago, I was a head teacher and didn't really have any intention of changing from that, really. But within that time, through the pandemic, we've stopped and gone through the financial upheaval, but also the you know, of taking on a franchise, finding a property, renovating it, opening and being open and trading successfully for 2 months. So I think we've done a lot in a short period of time. We're really proud of ourselves, I think, for that, really.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but we've worked hard at it, and I think we both always work hard, and we will do so. I don't think we'd likely just retire and do nothing, or we can't afford to. So,
So what are you most proud of in your life so far, Peter?
I think being proud of things is a real interesting kind of quality to have. I don't. When I feel like I've done something well, I'll be happy with that.
The word pride and proud just conjure up, like, makes some people feel a bit uncomfortable. So I understand that. So maybe, like, think of achievements, or what are you most happiest about what you've achieved?
I mean, the good fortune to find Ali, because we're pretty much, I think we're a rock for each other, and I've never felt supported like I do from anybody other than her. And it just, that's life enhancing. We all know how that feels, or I would hope we all know how that feels, but maybe some people don't. And I think that's a real blessing. And we work at it, we bicker, we're far from perfect, but I feel like I was very fortunate for that. In terms of a sense of personal achievement, I know that I did a good job as an educator, and whether you take that back to when I was a kind of rookie PE teacher in a private school at 21, or a head teacher, and I guess now as a yoga instructor, I feel when people develop a relationship with what you're trying to teach them and they take that further and they acknowledge that you lit a fuse, lit a spark, that's something that is always rewarding. In education, you don't often get that sense of recognition. It comes very infrequently. You're far too often told how you're getting everything wrong as an institution. But really, the ability to inspire other people, I think, is something that I've really, when that happens, I feel really humbled by it, rather than feeling proud. That's something that I feel very personally connected to, and it makes me feel good. And that's ultimately, I suppose, why I pursued that path of education in whatever form. So I think other things that are material or kind of achievement wise in terms of sport things, I don't really hold much kind of attachment to those sensations. I feel grateful that I've had opportunities. I think that's probably the top and bottom of it.
Yeah, no, I get that. So if you weren't a yoga teacher or teacher in general, what would you be?
Oh, it's a really difficult question. At this stage of my life, although I'm not sure I would find, I don't know how interesting, I toy and think the interest, like I, when I talk to people, I know I'm talking a lot now because obviously it's the direction of flow, but I find that people tend to open up to me quite quickly and almost ask my views, and I've developed that way of trying to support them find their own answers through a coaching conversation. So I wonder whether some form of like life coaching would be something that I would enjoy, just to support others to grow, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I get that. I guess it's not far removed from teaching, is it? It's like, yeah, you're not telling people the answer. Like you say, you're giving them opportunity for them to find their own answer. Yeah, but yeah, that's good. Okay.
Although I did love the refit, to be fair. And if I'd been a property developer and doing it myself, and like if somebody gifted me a property to do up and sell, which is never going to happen, but if they did, I would probably really enjoy being on the tools.
Interesting. Okay. Now you've got your own set of good tools, then you could crack on with that. All right. So quick fire questions now, please, Peter. There's no right or wrong. Just say what you think. Late to bed or early to rise?
I'm both. As you know, I got up at 10 to 3 this morning to go and surf down the coast, and I love it. So I would normally say early to rise, but if there's a party on, I don't want to miss anything.
Favorite tune to dance to?
Oh, there's so many. Prince is my addiction as a teenager, but I also was 16 in the 1990s, 17, going to raves. So it used to be Annie Mac on a Friday night, but anything that is rave, drum and bass orientated, I love it. Too many to make.
Who do you look up to?
I find that a really odd question, so it's ridiculous. Like, I'm going to fail on the quick answer here. The person I admire most is Ali.
That's it. That's all right. It's the same. I know I like looking up, but yeah, I get that. Favourite film?
Oh, God. Can I say Flashdance? No.
You can. You can say Flashdance. Good choice.
I haven't seen it for years, but I do like a good film. But yeah, that's nothing coming to mind. Out of Sight with George Clooney, I loved as well, with Jennifer Lopez. It was just different and had a good soundtrack by David Holmes.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how cool are you?
Well, I tell my children I'm 10 out of 10, 100%. I'm the coolest dad going. Are you not? That's just the rules. I'll let other people decide that.
Mountainside or lakeside?
They come together, don't they? There's normally a lake by a mountainside.
I mean, if you had to choose one.
I like the serenity of the mountains. It's been a long time since I've snowboarded, but it's just gorgeous when you're up in the hills there. So mountainside.
Tom Hanks or Leonardo DiCaprio?
Hanks.
But just Hanks. It's just Hanks for me.
It shouldn't be, because I think Ali's probably got a bit of a soft spot for him, but he just kind of seems to most likely get it right most of the time.
Yes, and I get what you're saying. What's your star sign, Peter?
Libra.
Who would you swap lives with just for a day?
Oh, I listened to Sydney's answer for this and I thought it was brilliant. I think I would probably go with somebody like Kelly Slater, who's one of the world's most famous surfers, but largely so I could just tap into his opportunity to be at the best possible surf on the planet at any one point in time. Other than that, it'd be good to be in the Dalai Lama's shoes for a day, wouldn't it? See what happens. See what he really thinks, get into his head.
Yeah. Countryside or city?
I love the hustle and bustle of a city. Yeah.
If you owned a yacht, what would you call it?
Something like, I was going to say Endeavour, but obviously that's quite really boring, isn't it? Because it's pretty, but I think I like the premise of that as a name.
Yeah. What is at the top of your bucket list?
I don't tend to have those things, to be fair. I feel like the opportunities come their way and you take them when they're there. If you attach too much to expectation, there's disappointment. I feel like I've lived a pretty full life already at 46. I'm really grateful for what I've got. So
that's a nice answer.
I mean, in terms of, it will be the obvious, which is seeing your children be happy.
Oh, that's a good one. Describe your baddest and brightest leggings. I mean, you're not really a leggings man, are you? Apart from the ballet days.
Well, exactly, yeah. I do very regularly wear leggings in the house when I come in from yoga. And my baddest ones are ones that only Ali ever gets to see, which is a good friend of mine set up a company called Finisterre, which is a really amazing brand based in the Southwest, but of kind of sustainable clothing. And they have long johns and he gifted me a set way back when, and I've worn them to death to the point that in the obvious place that has worn out, if I wear them and walk around the house in them, I feel quite comfortable, but it's probably not the best experience for any guests if they arrive.
I know exactly what you're saying and I understand. So your favorite place in the whole wide world?
Again, there'll be a couple of places, but home is undoubtedly one. Just I feel content there and nourished. But I think now increasingly there's a place that Ali and I stay in Bali called Temple Lodge, which just feels like a home from home, where you're looked after. It's really organic, natural. They've got a yoga studio there that's beautiful, and the couple who set it up and run it are just lovely people. And obviously there's surf on tap, and the fragrances, the smells of Bali, everything. It's an oasis within the bedlam that is Bali now, and you can still tap into that feeling of what it used to be like when I first started going.
Oh, lovely. What's your favorite yoga pose, Peter?
I thought about this and I honestly don't really know, because I like them all. I like the playfulness of yoga. So from that point of view, for me, I enjoy anything that involves getting back into my gymnastics days, like moving from crow to handstand and things like that, just feel like quite liberating. But I do love a good triangle.
Okay, good. That's the end of the questions. So have you got a favorite track or a bit of music that you like to Savasana, your Savasana sounds? Have you got something you can share with the listeners?
No, not for Savasana, but when I was in my teacher training, there was a DJ who was a friend of mine who was doing his training as well. And he made a soundtrack for our last teacher that we did. And I secretly used that, other than Hot Pod Sounds, which I shouldn't have done on our launch weekend on one of the classes, because it felt quite personal to me, because we'd done it together, really. it was contemporary and current. It had a song called Apricots by Biceps, which you'll have heard a lot through the past year probably, but that now always reminds me of my teacher training. It's really lifts me up, and it works in Shavasana as well as through the flow. But I'm also always, every time I hear, there's an album by Goldie called Timeless. Mm-hmm. And the first track is called Inner City Life, which is 20 minutes long.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just the most remarkable piece of modern classical music. And I quite often think you could do an entire yoga session to this song looped three times. Just beautiful.
That would be good, wouldn't it? I love that track as well. I know exactly the one you're talking about. And you don't hear it. It's always shortened and it's just disappointing. So yeah, I might have to go and seek it out and have a little listen, because can't remember the last time I heard it like the full length. But
oh, they've just re-released a remastered copy of the album, because I think it was 25 years or 30 years old, which is that crazy of age, isn't it? Yeah.
God, it can't be. No, it can't be 30 years, surely. Well, I'll have to have a look now. But yes, I know what you're talking about. And thank you for the other recommendation. I'll put those on the episode notes. So thank you, Peter, so much for chatting to me.
Well.
I really appreciate you sharing your story with me and the listeners. Listeners, you can contact Peter through his Instagram, which is at hotpodyogamorpeth, or by emailing him on morpeth@hotpodyoga.com. Please tell him what you thought of the podcast. If you've got any questions for him, I'm sure he'll be happy to answer them. Thanks, Peter.
You're welcome. Have a nice day, Jill. See you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So before my usual sign-off, I just wanted to let you know that this is the end of series one of the podcast. To make sure you don't miss the start of series two, subscribe. Press the subscribe button if you're in Apple Podcasts, or make sure that you follow if you're in Spotify, and then you'll be notified when the next episode comes up. In the meantime, you can always have a listen to the other 28 episodes and interviews I've recorded with yogis and yoga teachers over the last 12 months or so. Creating this podcast has really allowed me to get an insight into such interesting people's lives, and I love being able to share their stories, which I hope you agree are fascinating. So a big thank you to all my interviewees so far. You've been listening to That Yoga Woman's podcast with me, Jules Buchanan. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it, share it on social media, rate it, write a nice review, and subscribe to That Yoga Woman's podcast. Links and information can be found on the episode page in the podcast section of my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/podcast. If you'd like to show some support for the podcast, you can do that through PayPal. The donation link is www.paypal.me/thatyogawoman. The last thing I'll mention is my line of organic cotton yoga-inspired tops. I designed a small range of vests, tees and sweatshirts that are perfect to teach or do yoga in. Have a look online, check out my shop on my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/shop. Have a look around my store and make an order. See you soon.